about fighters for equity in a black education elected to the school board. That's well, just one.
Well, on that note, I can't believe that we are out of time. We might need to have a part two. We might need to have a part two of this, y'all. It's just been incredible.
I'd love to. Okay.
Yeah, Ashley Henderson, Gwendolyn Zahara Simmons, thank you so very much for joining us. Appreciate
thank you.
You
so much.
Thank you, Margaret. I love you, Zahara.
Okay.
I love you more.
Okay. Alrighty. A lot of love going there. Today's show produced by Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank our Sojourner Truth team, our intern, Julianne Tweeten, and our assistant producer, Ramiro Funes.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring a development director. This 32-hour-a-week position develops and implements the yearly fundraising plan, develops promotional and press materials, and supports the anti-oppression work of KBOO. Send a cover letter and resume to Delphine Crescenzo at del@kboo.org or send to KBOO Development Hire, 20 Southeast 8th, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Please answer in the cover letter the question, why is KBOO important? Deadline to apply is Sunday, November 25th at midnight. More information on the development director position is available at kboo.fm/developmenthire2018.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Top Dog Underdog, running Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays through December 1st at the Chapel Theater in Milwaukee. Top Dog Underdog tells the story of sibling rivalry between African-American brothers in a turbulent relationship punctuated with dark humor. Their names are Lincoln and Booth. The show has adult content and is not recommended for children. Again, that's Top Dog Underdog, running Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays through December 1st at the Chapel Theater, 4107 Southeast Harrison Street in Milwaukee. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time is 7:01 p.m. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is The Struggle.
Hello, KBOO listeners. This is Alyssa Pariah, your friendly neighborhood agitator. This is The Struggle, a weekly show that platforms people doing good work in the community so that they can tell you about what they do, why it's important, and why you might support them. So today, I have Alexander Reed Ross.
Hey, thanks very, very much for having me.
And Shane Burley.
Hey, thanks.
These are two Twitter famous writers that you should know about. They've both written fantastic books and write for Truth Out and Think Progress. Shane is Shane_Burley1 and Alexander is A. Reed Ross. And if y'all have questions for them throughout the show, you can tweet at them and we might answer them. So I want to bring forward the question of anti-fascism, why it's important, what its history is, and where the movement is going. Just this last weekend, there was a rally called Hymn 2 that was put on by some far-right people. And what they put forward was that we all, you, me, the people in this room, the people listening, should question women and people of all genders more than we already do when they come forward about being sexually assaulted or raped. Mm-hmm. And I think that is heinous. Mm. And five times as many people were there at their rally thought so too. And we had a counter demonstration. And I think it's very important to raise the banner of fighting the far right rather than shirking away from it. As both of my guests know, this is a popular position among many people who should be staunchly on our side, but because of fear, frustration, I'm not sure, they put forward that we should just ignore the right. But I know you two agree with that. And I think we should start off talking about that. Why are they wrong in that assessment?
Well, I think that we can't really unite with the right because the right is the formation of inequality, which is everything that we're trying to fight. So the idea that we could, you know, link up with the right wing and like fight capitalism or something like that is pretty much nonsense, because the right wing, if it's not capitalist, is pre-capitalist feudalist type identity. So it has to be confronted, and if we don't do it, then nobody will.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's this logic that comes up that we should maybe ignore them, that maybe they'll go away, that we're feeling your intention, but there's just no reality to that. The fact of the matter is that they want a platform where they can recruit, and the best thing that people can do is to deny them that platform, to create a large community for us that shuts it down. I mean, we don't want them there, and us coming out as a community and saying that we don't want them there is what's effective. And so I think that there's a lot of misgiving about how that actually takes place, but we should actually look at what actually effectively shuts down the right wing. We do, when we come together and we actually make a decision to do it. And so organized resistance to that is important. And I don't mean just, you know, in a park far away having a rally. What I mean is directly there and saying, no, our presence is a direct opposition to you, and that we're actually going to dismantle your functioning. We're not going to let you do what you want to do, because if they are able to win, then we lose.
Excellent.
Yeah. It's like that, the name of that movie, Sorry to Bother You, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, we have to inconvenience them, right? We can't just like stand on a sidewalk and wave a sign and then let them do whatever they want to do, right? We have to actually stop them.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Well, when y'all talked about what shuts them down, what works, if y'all could talk about the history of how our side has been able to fight back effectively, to give people some hope in terms of what they might want to take away as a lesson and maybe duplicate.
Yeah, I mean, so that there's a long history there, right? I mean,
we got time.
Yeah, I mean, I was just thinking immediately of the civil rights movement and, you know, the Deacons for Defense, the NAACP, with Robert Williams, armed community defense to prevent the Klan and white supremacist organizations from crushing the civil rights movement by literally killing and terrorizing its leaders, right? So that's, in the United States, I think, the direct history of groups like Anti-Racist Action, which came out in the 1980s to confront the Klan and the Nazis, the fascist skinheads who were coalescing. You know, and there's other groups in Europe, you know, Antifascistische Aktion, right, for the Communist Party in Germany.
Anti-Fascist Action in Britain.
Yeah, AFA and the ANL, Anti-Nazi League. Different approaches for different movements. You know, there's like violent, you know, defense structure on one hand, groups like Red Action, and then on the other hand, the ANL or Rock Against Racism, very mainstream groups trying, and movements really trying to just organize mass groups of people to come out and oppose racism through public manifestations, rock concerts, you know.
Yeah, and I think there's a history of a spectrum here, right? So like there's, you know, on the one hand, maybe more distant protests, ones that bring out large sections of people, and then there's ones that are more confrontational on the other hand that directly try and interfere physically with whatever is happening. And in a lot of ways, it takes kind of that whole broad spectrum, right? Like it's going to require large masses of people. It also requires people that are willing to disrupt those things. It requires kind of a whole range. And so what a lot of developed kind of in post-war Europe, when we started seeing like what we call like neo-fascist parties, as neo-Nazis. They're trying to reclaim this, redefine themselves, find a new space for them, was that they were, again, trying to take a public stage, and people are coming out and figuring out organized ways of dismantling that. So is it blocking them in the streets? Is it shutting down their meeting? Is it also doing other things? Is it education, too, right? Is it going after their key arguments? You know, if they're going to build, like, an anti-immigrant sentiment, we should start talking about immigration in our communities. You know, if they're going to start creating, like, all these, like, canards about queer folks in the 80s and later trans folks in the 90s and early 2000s, then we need to be talking about those things. That's an anti-fascist organizing too. And so I think, like, all of those things together ended up kind of being ported over to the U.S. and the growing neo-fascist movements there and people trying to make sense of them. So right now the word Antifa is kind of used as a capsule, but it's not. You know, it's one particular type of confrontational organizing that's, you know, obviously seen a lot of effectiveness, and there's a lot of other types too. But it's used as a blanket to kind of insult the anti-fascist movement when it's actually really diverse and also really effective in the fact that it's actually seen a lot of measurable gains by shutting them down.
Excellent. Well, go ahead.
And let's also talk about intra-movement solidarity against fascism, because the thing that fascists like to do is try to intrigue within different movements, like the environmental movement, for example, and spread anti-immigration stuff. And anti-fascists within those movements, you know, might not be completely organized in one way or the other, but will work to kick the fascist influence out of their respective groups. So that's an important aspect of anti-fascism that is often unacknowledged or unrecognized, but people do it every day.
All right. Well, I want to get into some of the more sort of overtly connected movements where, and I think it's important that we acknowledge this and that we have an answer to this. People will say, and they often do, even to me, that Proud Boys, Patriot Prayer, some of the other right formations that are sort of alt-right or fall under that umbrella that read Breitbart and, you know, like, the, like them, they say, we are not fascists. And why would you be imposing on us your ideas and calling us something that we don't identify as? Yet there doesn't seem to be, at least in my opinion, and you know, I think we should be able to be critical of ourselves. There's not a forthright enough answer to those people who some of them really are confused and genuinely don't think of themselves as fascist. What do we have to say to that? What should we be saying?
I mean, I think we need to look at what they do, not just what they say, right? So Patriot Prayer is a really good example. Patriot Prayer, for those who aren't in Portland, is this kind of far-right Trumpian group that formed around Trump's election in Portland, started having these rallies. And what became really apparent really quick was that despite what maybe the core organizers say that they believe, they have white nationalists there. They have neo-Nazi skinheads that were there. They had open racist alt-right folks that were participating. And when confronted about that, they did nothing about it. And instead, they continued to push anti-immigrant rhetoric, anti-Muslim rhetoric, homophobic rhetoric. And so it was what they actually did functionally. Now, I'm sure there's some people that are just, you know, more like conservative types, right?
Yeah,
maybe they
sure.
don't go for full right. But in a way, that doesn't matter because they have functionally been the most effective organizing tool for the far right. And that's what really matters. Are they going to do something about it? Are they going to stop that from happening? They're not, so somebody has to.
Okay.
And we also just have to oppose violent right-wing extremism, you know, that's taken over the streets. It doesn't matter if it calls itself monarchist or fascist or, you know, who knows what. They could be leprechauns for all I care. But, you know, what they're trying to do is perform this sense of nationalism that is blocking other people from their rights, from equality, from full equality. I mean, they've been coming out and protesting Pride unsuccessfully, protesting Planned Parenthood, you know. So what they're doing is creating physical crises for people who are marginalized and vulnerable within our society. They are opening the door to white nationalists. If you look at the Proud Boys, you mentioned the Proud Boys, their Indiana leader was Brian James, who founded the Vinlanders Social Club, was a former Klansman and Hammerskin, outlaw Hammerskin. So, I mean, they've got, and then after they, as some people started talking about Brian, he formed American Guard, which is a violent white supremacist skinhead group that joined the Proud Boys in the streets trying to wail on, and Tiny was there wailing on people in Providence, Rhode Island, just like a couple months ago. So, you know, they're rallying with fascists, and that's all part of what they do. They're trying to create the big tent. And
yeah, and you know, like, there's, they will use the cover of all kinds of identities in histories. That's always been true. That's not a new concept. Mm-hmm. You know, like, you know, we were covering skinhead meetings, you know, 10, 15 years ago, and there were folks of color that would sometimes come to them. That wasn't maybe the usual thing, but that's not the usual thing for the Proud Boys, but they're using it as a smokescreen to try and confuse people
it's
what's
wild.
Going on.
Yeah.
And so the reality is that the Proud Boys or Patriot Prayer are a violent street gang that's basically attacking marginalized communities. That's the fact of the matter, and it doesn't matter what they call themselves, what t-shirt they wear, what they look at in the morning, this is what they do. Mm-hmm. And so I think we should definitely look at what are the facts of the matter, what is actually the result of their organizing.
Okay. I just realized that we sort of jumped the gun a little bit and we're 15 minutes in. I want to point to your two book titles, and I didn't even plug them, and I'm sorry. So Shane's book is called Fascism Today, What It Is and How to End It. A little wink at Trotsky. Lovely. And Alexander's is Against the Fascist Creep. And being that you two have written so much scholarly work on the subject, for confused or sort of just not that well informed yet people, can you give me an elevator pitch, or not a pitch, an elevator speech about what fascism is? Elevator, please.
I'll do that.
Okay.
So I guess I use basically two tent poles to describe it. One is this belief in inequality. You know, most of the world tries to deny that inequality exists. That's kind of the neoliberal project. But fascists don't just refuse to deny it. They think it's sanctified. They think people, things should be unequal. People are unequal. Societies are unequal. Okay. And then the other side, it's that we're wrapped up in our identities and they control us. Basically, it's essential identities. That they're identities that choose us. We don't choose them. And so it's either race, gender orientation. There's like a number of different kind of poles of it, but basically it's defining. And when you match those two together and you kind of create a populist upsurge mythic movement around it, that's when you have fascism.
Yeah, it's really like the white identitarianism that's really taken off most recently, and it's the kind of vogue of the new synthesis of fascists. Because what they can do under this idea of white identity politics is, first of all, try to mock the left and draw in some of those left-wing kind of ideas, which furthers their sort of semi-populist approach to we are the natural elites, right? So they establish the big hierarchy with them at the top by gleaning ideology from the left in a really disingenuous way.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that I always thought was really telling is that they're not just kind of critiquing the left, they are a critique on the left. So if we talk about identity politics, they'll do it better. You know, if we're there organizing the working class, they'll talk to the working class. Like, they will always find the weak points of the left, and they'll take our tools and our methods and they'll use them against us.
Excellent. Yeah, that was exactly where I hoped you would go, and I knew you would go. You did not let me down. Yes, I think it's important to bring up that what, from my understanding, what the right hopes to do, or the far right hopes to do, is to be able to have an answer to areas that the left is really lacking and is unable or unwilling sometimes to really take up. And Alexander, you talked about taking on a populist approach and gleaning ideology from the left. And particularly, I want to talk about this in terms of their anti-PC championing, where I think they are very adept in being able to identify that many people are exhausted by what I might call sort of university identity politics, right? The heavy focus on interpersonal dimensions that sort of are representations of an unequal system, but really don't make any move toward changing the system itself. That's my critique of it. Anyhow, I think that I'm seeing the right use this anti-PC politically correct pivot in order to advance a lot of their ideas, and being able to draw people in and sort of say, aren't you so sick of being told about how you're so privileged and you're so problematic and that, you know, you need to be called out on your bad behavior? And I think that there are many people that say, yeah, mm-hmm. I really am. Yeah. It does bother me. And I know that the reason that they can reach them is because we actually don't have a very good answer to those people. And many of my friends, I love them dearly, they come from oppressed backgrounds, and they take up the mantle or the call that says, it's not my job to educate my oppressor or to make them like me. Mm-hmm. And I think that's correct and that's righteous. I don't know if it's strategic. Mm-hmm. And I hope to be able to develop a cadre of people from oppressed communities who will be able to have something very sharp to say to those people, because I just don't know if shooing them away and saying, whatever, you're problematic and F you forever, is very helpful. In fact, I think it can be detrimental, because as y'all were pointing out, the right is able to pick that up and run with it. Can you talk about what you think might be a possible solution or something toward a solution for that?
Yeah, you know, there's this old IWW poster. It has a worker and a Klansman talking to him, and it says, if you're not talking to your coworker, somebody will be.
Ah.
You know, at one point, the left gave up organizing the working class in a certain degree. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to go back to talking about where people are at, talking about how to confront those things and how to not just abandon whole swaths of folks, but mm-hmm. to use it as a point of critical struggle and to use those parts as places to struggle with people to a degree. I don't think we should give up defense and also holding people accountable and holding standards up.
Sure.
Because we can do both those things. But I think what the right does in a lot of degrees is take like angst, like you were saying, that yeah. people have about this, or their inability to navigate what is essentially kind of a university language or like an upper class language sometimes, and the feeling alienated by that, sometimes generationally, and then using it to say, see, they're not with you. We will be. We will yeah. speak to that. And if we're not willing to speak to especially people from the working class and confront those issues with them, then we've kind of lost that.
Hmm. And it's not only the working class, too. I mean, we have to take into account things like 4chan, mm-hmm. Meme culture, because that's something I think that the far right took and ran with, hacker culture, Weave, you know, those types of people. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, a lot of the left sort of broke off, especially the left that was really skilled with memes, and sort of formed like tanky sort of weird sort of cliques that became really alienating to a lot of people at the same time. Just, you know,
a lot of gulag memes.
A lot of gulag yeah. memes and all that kind yeah. of stuff. So I think like, yeah, in order to be more relatable and to use those kinds of tools, you know, we have to actually sort of break out of sectarianism, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, when Obama was in power, a lot of people on the left thought, oh, we could be a little more comfortable now. We can take for granted a lot more. Mm-hmm. We're on the move, you know, we're taking the streets every other week yeah. and all that kind of stuff. And as a result, there was a kind of a weird thing that happened in the radicalization process that developed these kinds of like siloed political structures. Mm. And I think right now we have to be in a process of breaking those down and reforming a kind of mass movement.
Can you talk about those political structures that were siloed?
I think there were more kind of MLM groups emerging.
Can you say what MLM
is? Oh, sorry. Marxist-Leninist, Maoist groups. Yeah. I think we saw especially... Okay, so this is something kind of crazy that involves like political geography. we saw tensions increase between Russia and the United States. And a lot of leftists in the United States, anti-imperialists, believed that this meant that we should support Russia because Russia might be helpful as an anti-imperialist sort of counterpower. And then we saw Russia and RT and Sputnik in 2013 dually or reciprocally support these kinds of left-wing groups, anti-imperialist groups. And so what we saw with RT and with Sputnik was a convergence of the US left and far right wing commentators coming together to try and build a populist movement of, say, anti-imperialists and right-wing isolationists who supported Russia's sort of geopolitical interests, and as a result have steadily kind of isolated themselves from mainstream discourse in the United States.
And it's your position that this is what gave rise or helped give rise to some of the right's ascension? Is that?
Well, I don't think that there's much of a doubt in my mind that the alt-right took advantage of RT Sputnik to spread. You had people like Jared Taylor, Richard Spencer, Matt Heimbach all going on RT, getting platforms there. At the same time, I think that they have developed a sort of a fringe fusion of left and right.
Well, unless you have Shane, unless you have something to go off of this, I'd like to ask you a question. Okay, so again, I think I jumped the gun a little bit. On this show, I like to remind myself as often as I can, and my guests lovingly, that much of what we know and say, many people do not know and do not say. So I want to not assume. So actually, alt-right, the alternative to the traditional right. Can y'all, again, elevator, right? What is the right that they're griping about, and why do they feel like they need to be an alternative to it, and what makes it alternative?
Yeah, I mean, the right they have a problem with is the GOP, and basically conservatism as an idea. So conservatism is
GOP, the Republican Party.
So it's basically built on kind of three platforms: free market economics, social conservatism, and kind of Christian ethics. And also like a hawkish foreign policy. And those sorts of things are much different than like a belief in human inequality. Like you could theoretically be like a libertarian and say, yeah, no, all people are created equal, but I still think we should, you know, bomb other countries and, you know, cut taxes and things like that. And they're like, no, we're a totally different starting point. Our starting point is white identity. Our starting point is like, you know, the essential traditional family, things like that. We won't even get into like even to engage in your version of politics is to give up our principles and our completely different starting point. So when they created an alternative right, 2010-ish, they basically wanted to have a white nationalism that was way more radical than whatever the Republican Party could do and say like, no, we're starting over. We're totally not a part of that. And we're going to be something all our own.
So, also Richard Spencer, right? Like, he is known for being the person that sort of popularized it and put it forward as like a national movement that people should rally behind. He is the guy that famously got punched in the face in Washington, D.C. And I was one block away when that happened. The longest block of my life that I couldn't see that with my own eyes. So I want people to have a conception of that. So thank you for laying it out, because where I think many people are getting tripped up is in calling conservatives Nazis. And while there may be some overlap, I think it's not a good idea to lump them in. So I wanted to be able to draw that out, to be able to say like, why is the alt-right calling themselves the alt-right and not just the right? Mm-hmm. So thank you for being able to tease that out.
It's also anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the huge, the big part of it in foreign policy terms is the notion that Israel should be defended. And this goes back to Pat Buchanan, you know, what's called the paleocons, who opposed the neoconservative agenda from the Nixon administration to the Bush administrations. And, you know, you hear people like Richard Spencer say, well, actually, you know, the state of Israel is a great example of an ethno-state. But, well, you know, is. Like...
Sadly.
The thing is, we can't take them at their word that they actually support the state of Israel.
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah. No. Don't believe anything they say.
Yeah. And when you have people like Steve Bannon who are like, yeah, totally support Israel and like part of the Judeo-Christian tradition and things like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have to look at the fascist movement as a process and not just like, and that's why it's so important to oppose them now. And not wait until you have like brown shirts in full uniform, you know, in the hundreds of thousands marching through the streets. So yeah, just wanted to add that little tidbit.
I think it's important because there is a conspiratorial worldview to it, then that's really centered on anti-Semitism. The idea that a small cabal of people can control affairs. It's not just like a capitalist class where they have class interest. Mm-hmm. It's instead it's a tribal ethnic group that has tribal ethnic interests. Mm-hmm. And that's a really big distinction because they want to see the world as competing ethnic groups. That makes sense for them.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for bringing that up because you didn't say it, but you winked at it. Globalists, which is a slur, really, against Jewish people. Trump came out as a nationalist. He said it. I'm not a globalist. I'm a nationalist. And this was met to a lot of applause and then not a lot of concern, frankly, which was concerning to me. But can you tease that out a little bit? You talked about, you know, there being a secret cabal that's sort of running things internationally rather than the more natural order or what they would put forward as a natural order of competing nations and races. But that at the head of this cabal are Jewish people and they're part of a globalist conspiracy. Please tease that out because it animates a lot of them.
Yeah, I mean, and so Jews, as the image go, don't have their own nation, so they get into host nations and they undermine those nations so that they can have more power. And they do that by undermining national identity. And by doing so, it helps them, you know, protect them from anti-Semitism and they can gain more power. And so the counter narrative is like if they have strong nationalism where they don't let these invaders that use Crips and turn their good, you know, thinking morality against itself, then they would be able to have a lot of stronger power in the world community. And the idea is that if Jews don't have nations of their own, if they were just a, you know, parasites in these other nations, then why wouldn't they be internationalists? They want to destroy those nations because then they're more powerful. When nations don't have their own interests, they become more powerful. And this is echoed all through of Trump's language, through Bannon's language, this idea of the globalist, that that it's apparently wrong to think globally in terms. You know, we use the term internationalist very proudly, and I think we should be using that term. But what they want to do is turn it on its head and say, no, what you're doing is actually letting a small cabal of people, whether they say Jews or not, that's what they mean, and that they're turning the nation against its own interests.
Okay. Thank you. Well, I think now it's time to talk about immigration, right? We're about halfway through the show, so I wanted to set us up correctly with some background terms and ideas. And now, oh my goodness. Okay. Anyone that has anyone that is in the caravan right now, you know, just, you know, give them all the love. It is, it's so scary, so heartbreaking what it is that a lot of the people in the caravan are going through. Not that we should be getting into the weeds here, but, you know, the countries that they come from were made horrendous and impossible for them to live because of CIA-backed coups and undermining their democratic process. But again, sorry, won't get into that. But I want to bring up that the right, Trump and his ilk, do not call it the caravan, but rather call it an invasion. And that is something that's politically expedient for them, and it's something that animates his base. And please, y'all, talk about the central focus of the immigrant in the fascist program and why it's so dangerous.
It's definitely nothing new. In his short handbook to fascism, Passmore writes about the early sort of pre-fascist movement in France led by Maurice Barres, literally fighting against Italian immigrants who were workers in the south of France as invaders, mm-hmm. right? And so even in the late 19th century, you have these like seriously xenophobic ultra-nationalist movements that are trying to build a national solidarity, a chauvinist solidarity against foreigners in their country, right? And it was also the specter of the Jew, right? Because it wasn't just French Jews or Austrian Jews, it was Eastern European Jews who are dirty and poor and they're moving in here. And by doing that, they were even able to turn some sort of Austrian Jews and French Jews against those foreign Jews. So mm-hmm. it's dividing people, right? And that is what we see in the United States as well, is that the immigrant is different from that race or what have you. So you can form a kind of nativist nationalist bloc like the Proud Boys do, with in some ways a multiracial group that disavows immigrants and says we need to close our borders, mm-hmm. right? And there's just all this literature that has been used dating back to, you know, the 70s, and this idea of decolonization as spilling over into Europe as a decivilizing element, as an invasion when the Jews take over, right, is the narrative that the Jews have taken over. They're using immigrants as leverage. And at no time, I think, in European history have we seen that the feverish level of anti-immigrant frenzy as today with Syrian refugees, and the idea that the Zionists, it's Israelis basically, Israel and the Israel lobby, is destroying Syria in order to unleash Syrian refugees on Europe and dilute the cultural integrity of European peoples.
Yeah, I mean, he blames immigrants because it works. Mm-hmm. And it helps him speak to a working class that he's abandoning. So the reality is that Trump is destroying labor unions right now. That's the reality. That he is using tariff policies that's basically going to shut down, you know, lots of rural parts of the U.S., tax policy that's going to destroy low-income folks. Like, what he's doing is fundamentally anti-working class, yet he can send them something and talk about immigrants and say, oh, they're taking your jobs, mm-hmm. they're affecting your safety, things like that. So he's able to take class struggle, real experienced class struggle of people going through, you know, hard times economically, and switch it back into an anti-immigrant narrative. Mm-hmm. So it's allowing him to gain that foothold while also taking things away from working people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, goodness. And the caravan, you're absolutely right. It's something like as part of solidarity and left-wing opposition movements in, you know, Latin America that's been going on for decades and decades. Just this idea, like in Colombia about 10 years ago, there was this thing called the Minga, which was indigenous people opposing a free trade agreement, opposing the extraction of raw materials, oil and things like that from the rainforests and the destruction of their environment, their land. And so they created this Minga, which was tens of thousands of people that peacefully marched through all of Colombia. And it really kind of like moved the world, you know, in this peaceful way. And I think that we're seeing with the caravan something very similar, you know. It's just it's like the March on Washington or something like that. It's not an invasion, you know, and that kind of rhetoric that's emerged with Tucker Carlson really has it shares a lot with the rest, the gamut of white nationalist talking points, like white genocide.
So, yes, absolutely. And Tucker Carlson and people like him are able to stoke fear. Mm-hmm. And please, you know, don't roll your eyes when I ask this question. I'm not asking for me, but for people that want to have an answer to people that follow Tucker Carlson. So when they repeat those talking points, what should people be saying back? Like, let's arm the people with ideas here.
I mean, I think the first thing is he's a liar. Like, he's telling open lies. What he's saying isn't true. I mean, this is a real talk radio kind of point, is to take somewhat true facts, mix them in with lies so they become indistinguishable. So a lot of what Tucker Carlson says is just point blank factually untrue. The other thing is that, like, there's a pattern here. When you're focusing entirely on non-white immigrants, folks in really dire economic and personal situations, and you're not doing that to the exclusion of all others, that makes a really clear picture. Also, Tucker Carlson's uniform defense of the rich. He punches down. That's the reality. And we're talking about marginalized people, working class people. We don't have that kind of power. Tucker Carlson does, and he uses it to only punch down and never punch up.
Hmm. That's right. And what is he really doing? I mean, like, are people really that afraid of gypsies, for example? Like, he gets on his show and rants and raves about gypsies, so-called, right? This is just, like, this kind of weird, you know, idiosyncratic way of porting in these kinds of radical right talking points from an obviously sort of like white supremacist European theme. And it doesn't make any sense in the context of the United States. So what he's doing is, like, it's very pretentious in a way. It's like, how are you relating to Tucker Carlson, you know? The bow tie guy.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I mean, he's trumping up facts and lying about, for example, immigrant crime rates, which are factually untrue, what he's saying. They don't have higher crime rates. Making up lies about Syrian refugees that are factually untrue. And I think we need to reinforce the fact that, like, what he's saying isn't true, like, those communities aren't engaging in crime, whatever he seems to think, and to start to unpack this idea that they're invaders, because what it's doing is looking at poor people and calling them something else. That way we can dehumanize them and we don't have to see their struggle as the same as ours.
Yeah, no middle class people on the caravan.
Right.
Okay, thank you. Well, another central pivot for them, we have to get here too at 40 minutes in now. Black Lives Matter and the police. Right? Like, one of the things, a lot of these right wingers, they come to, I'm a member of Don't Shoot Portland. We just did a great action outside of City Hall today. Another one, you know, much to Ted Wheeler's chagrin, we are protesting all over your city council, Ted Wheeler. Black Lives Matter, not Black Friday, which, you know, calls into question the consumerism of Black Friday, and we turned it on its head, and we're actually just giving away everything that we had. So we did a clothing drive, jackets, blankets, and just gave them out to whoever needed them. Hot meals, same thing, you know, what do you need? And a thing that seems to be animating a lot of the alt-right is the assertion that Black Lives Matter is a terrorist organization, and that we need to support police, right? They love their thin blue line, you know, emblems, and they love the police so much. Can we talk about the centrality of anti-Black racism on the far right, and then also the relationship that they have to the police? Like, we have to go there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was Gavin McGinnis said that the Proud Boys have some great contacts with the New York City police. Mm-hmm. Patriot Prayer here in the Northwest interfaces with the Portland police and provides intel, apparently, to the Seattle police.
Can you talk about that interfacing, or can you not?
Well, I mean, they're open about it, right? Okay. The police say that they're liaising with Patriot Prayer, and they claim that they'll, you know, liaise with anybody who is part of any protests.
Yeah, we see how they liaise with Black protesters.
Yeah, by shooting people in the head. Yeah. So yeah, it's hard to have a lot of faith in the police when they, you know, have zero accountability after committing heinous crimes. And, you know, Black Lives Matter was really kind of one of the, I guess, precursors to anti-fascist mass mobilizations that we've seen. And in fact, it was Black Lives Matter trans folks who mobilized in Chicago, the famous rally against Trump. Boston, when 40,000 people showed, you know, to show the Proud Boys the door there. So, you know, obviously this is like a crucial matter for anti-fascist movements. And you're right, the source of the sort of launching of the alt-right in around like 2014, 2015 mm-hmm. was really the backlash against Black Lives Matter, and really relied on some kind of latent systemic racism in the United States.
Yeah, I mean, the alt-right requires, in a lot of ways, for white resentment to be true. And for that to be true, it has to mean that what's happening to Black people is fair and just.
Oof.
And so a narrative has to emerge that what to everyone else, well, maybe not to everyone else, but at least to us, is very obvious police murder of Black people is done as simple self-defense, and the movements against it are movements against Black accountability or something like that. And so that's a really required narrative. You know, they can't accept, we can't accept a narrative that says that one group of people are actually being mistreated. Like, it can't actually accept that narrative, because then that would say there's actually systemic inequality taking place. And instead, what they want to say is, nope, that's people's own doing. That's just their culture. That's their society. And this is a fair response by the police.
Yeah.
And that's always going to be required. They have to disbelieve Black people for their narrative to be true.
Yeah. Thank you. I also want to just bring in quickly, that the era after the you know, Emancipation Proclamation, sort of the formal ending of illegal slavery in the United States, was followed by an era called Reconstruction, which set out to begin to right the wrongs in a very, very humble way through a series of small reforms that would allow for formerly enslaved people to be able to begin their lives as free people. And almost immediately, the backlash to that was an era of white terror with groups like the Klan that fought back against the very project of Reconstruction and were able to successfully overturn it, which right. I think is so central to why I think the alt-right needs to be called to the floor on what time and time again they will say is sort of Black people destroying their own communities and not being respectful enough to the police. And that they actually have had a fair shake, and that the racism of which we speak is imagined. Mm-hmm. And I must hearken back to that reign of terror against Reconstruction, because those are actually their ancestors. Yep. Like that's who many of them come from. And they never wanted Black people to have anything close to a fair shake in this country, so much so that they made it their point to find Black people to kill, lynch, and terrorize them, to the point that the meager federal program and set of federal programs that was called Reconstruction ended up being overturned. And then we get the Black Codes and Jim Crow, which was legalized and systemic, open disadvantage and discrimination. And I just wanted to bring that in, that like this is their heritage. When they say that, you know, we're talking about heritage and not hate, like your heritage is hate.
Yep, exactly. And one of the important things about Reconstruction, right, is that that was the 14th Amendment. That's where the Civil Rights Amendment was passed, which has experienced a full-on attack by the Trump administration. He tried to basically write it off with an executive order because birthright citizenship is enfranchised within the 14th Amendment. And so what I've seen with all of that stuff, you know, it was back during his campaign rally in 2015 when he was talking about this in Alabama, and Jeff Sessions got on stage with his little MAGA hat and somebody yelled white power in the audience. And he was talking about the 14th Amendment. He was saying, you know, we're going to deal with that. There are ways of dealing with that without getting, you know, involving Congress and stuff like that. Well, no, there aren't. At the same time, what he's talking about is going back to a pre-Civil War code of politics.
Yeah, and I think anytime someone tells you that the alt-right is small, they're ineffectual, they're weirdos, they're not going to do anything, it doesn't take a large... population of white vigilantes to actually affect an entire nation's policy and affect millions and millions of people. I mean, you're talking about, when you're talking about the Reign of Terror, it wasn't a ton of people, but it was a really effective number of people that basically ended Reconstruction and established Jim Crow. The same thing happened in response to the Civil Rights Movement, the Third Era Klan. It's happening now in response to Black Lives Matter and other movements. And so it doesn't require there to be a mass cultural shift yet for it to happen. And so I think that's really important. And the other thing is that, you know, systemic white supremacy relies on that extra legal violence, you know, the violence of just a few people staking out. And so that's why it's really critical.
Yeah. They want to put down the left so that nobody will oppose them when they do this kind of stuff.
Right. You Thank know. You for bringing that in. My next point was exactly about high profile people that, you know, may have some cachet with people who believe in social justice that assert that we should ignore them. And I know that we went over a little bit of this when we first began speaking about this, but I want to know how listeners might be able to, again, arm themselves with ideas to be able to speak against that when they hear it or read it on Twitter. Because these kind of positions are actually quite popular, because if you can rely on the old notion that, you know, if you ignore a bully, he'll go away. You know, many people, it's like common sense, but it's common sense that'll get you killed if you're not careful. Mm-hmm. So, what can we help people to say back to that? What kind of answer?
I think maybe look at a record of success. I mean, look at the groups that have crashed and burned, mm-hmm. and point out, as Shane did earlier, that, you know, they didn't crash and burn just because they, you know, accidentally tied their own shoes together. Mm. You know, somebody had to tie their shoes together.
Yeah, yeah. I think when it comes to debates, I mean, the first thing is knowing when not to do that. You know, like, I think there's disingenuous debate that's meant to draw people into conversation so that they can do recruitment.
And I think that's, talk about that?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So
how does that happen?
So with a member of the far right, what they'll do is develop talking points that maybe sound kind of ambiguous, or maybe even sound good in certain sense.
Just ask some questions.
Yeah, yeah. Like, why? I just don't understand. Will you talk with me about it? And that's what they want. And that's a disingenuous thing. Like, it's a strategic platform to be able to try and poke holes into the opposition, to find places where they haven't thought things through, or find stuff that doesn't immediately make sense to a passerby, and then use that as a recruitment tool. That's disingenuous. I don't think that's useful. That's different than comradely debate, because that happens in the left or maybe in your family and things like that, and being able to confront those issues. I think the reality is that we don't have a lot of those answers that people are poking holes in off the bat. And why would we? You know, but I think it's important to try and focus on discovering those things. Let's look at the reality of how immigration works. Let's look at the reality of how labor works. You know, like, how does the labor movement successful? What does policies like closed borders have on countries? Because we can look at the actual effects of that, and it's not what the alt-right says. That's not real. Mm-hmm. You know, a race science. Those things are not real as much as the alt-right tries to prove it. And we can, that's easily provable. But I think we need to decide when that's useful, because I don't think letting them set the terms of the conversation is ever useful. And I don't think letting them draw you into debate is useful either. I think shutting them down in response is useful. But when it comes to internal agitation, I think it's important that we confront those issues that come up, research them, and then are able to make those arguments interpersonally.
Okay. So sort of on the macro level, when you're speaking about that interpersonally, right, like tools that people can use, and I actually think that was very helpful. In fact, I think I might, you know, post show, find that clip and segment it and then use it to help people. But on a macro level, one of the things that we often talk about is normalization, and how that functions to sort of push, this is a little bit of a wonky framework, but the Overton window, which is like the frame that is considered acceptable political discourse, that if you're able to move it in any direction, then that will, you know, help one side or the other. And to me, what it looks like is that the process of normalization hopes to move the Overton window so far to the right that the ideas that end up coming in through the side door are generally accepted and not widely fought against. Can y'all talk about what normalization looks like? Where does it come from? And what function does it serve, please?
I mean, it's incredible, Alyssa. Like, the other day I said something about how... you know, something about like the genocide of indigenous people in the United States.
No doubt.
On Twitter, and some people chimed in and were like, oh, yeah, yeah, like genocide, you mean like, you know, diseases.
Oh.
And I was just like, where are we as a society where we're like denying the full scale genocide of Native people in the United States to,
is this a
to
real
build
person
the United
and not a
States.
Troll or?
Yeah.
All right.
So, you know, that's normalization right there. That is the normalization of genocide. And you can't deny genocide in any instance because it opens the door for genocide denial, you know? And what this person was doing was literally genocide denial. Like, oh, the concept of genocide. I mean, have you ever heard of the Neolithic Revolution? Like, have you ever, this is just what societies do, right? They colonize, they conquer, like it's them or us type of attitude, right?
Yeah.
And that just doesn't work. That's just not true, you know. It's like that's an extremely negative, pessimistic way of viewing humanity, you know. And I hope that works for you, guy, but like that's not the way that things are, you know. And we need to be able to reject the denial of genocide, because I'll tell you, people who are denying genocide in these kinds of cases will also try to rewrite history about the Holocaust. And you know, pointing to the true factual history of the atrocities of fascists throughout the existence of fascism is the best way of showing, look, this movement is absolute garbage.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's intuitive. It is garbage because it tells all of us that we suck.
Right.
But it's also a historical fact.
Yeah, I think right now, if you were to go publicly and say, hey, I'm a white nationalist, you know, that might get you punched in the face.
I hope
but,
so.
But what happens when there's enough white nationalists that people are just like, oh, okay, I disagree with that. That, oh, or even more than that, oh, you're just a white nationalist. Oh, yeah, I know some of those. I think what normalization is that when things that were really shocking, their ideas about immigration, their ideas about Jews, become so commonplace that people are like, well, I can't be shocked by everything, you know, like, and that it becomes a normal part of the discourse. And that's happened to a degree. Mm. It's not shocking to say, oh, there's a white nationalist rally happening. 10 years ago, that would have been really frightening. That would have been a really strange thing. Mm-hmm. But now it's just like, another one?
Yeah.
And so the process of normalization is basically saying ideas and having actions that used to be so outside of the frame, but now become commonplace. And that shifts what you said, the Overton window. So now what's considered acceptable discourse has widened to a degree to include really, really far-right ideas that were considered totally out there like 5 or 10 years ago.
Yes.
And there's like this kind of like trap, right? There's like a way of you mentioned trolling, right? Trolling people using memes, pushing what's acceptable, and then if somebody gets upset, responding with, oh, you're triggered, or like, you know, like making fun of somebody's emotional response.
A human
to things
response.
That are, yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. So, you know, society needs to be kind of sensitive to these kinds of things and to actually accept that certain things are rage inducing and intended to be rage inducing, and that's okay, right? Anger is a rational response to oppressive violence.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, I want to bring in finally what I see as a great step forward in terms of the anti-fascist movement, and that is with Pop Mob, or Popular Mobilization. They are the organization that held the counter demonstration against the Him2 rally that tried to normalize and make people question women and survivors of all genders who had come through sexual assault and rape. I want to lift them up because I think it's a great way for people that are not already in the anti-fascist movement to be able to plug into something that's already happening. Popular mobilization is on all platforms, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. You can check them out on Google. And I think that people that are listening in the Portland area could do very well to work with an organization that does not do direct face-to-face stuff with the fascists, like many of our friends that block up at protests. Rather, they seek to make a popular front against fascism and turn out as many people as possible and sort of make it as safe as possible through numbers. And I suggest that people look into that if they're feeling like they're ready to confront the far right. So Alexander, Shane, thank y'all both for being here. Y'all are brilliant.
Well, thanks very much for having us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having us on.
All right. Okay, I'll talk to y'all next week on The Struggle. Thank you.
The time is 8 o'clock, and you're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, your community radio of choice. And I have a very important message for you. It's so important, it's called 001. Ever wonder what happens to your Fred Meyer reward points? Now you can turn them into excellent community radio by linking your Fred Meyer rewards card to KBOO. Look up KBOO or our ID number 86634. That's ID number 86634 at fredmeyer.com/community rewards. Customers can earn donations for KBOO by shopping with a rewards card. And all you have to do is log in to your online account and link your rewards card to KBOO. At the end of each quarter, Fred Meyer will make a donation to KBOO based on accumulated spending. Enrolling is an easy process that's clearly outlined on the site. You can enroll at any time. Again, that's KBOO with Fred Myers. The ID number is 86634 at fredmeyer.com. And